TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. The Loss of West Antarctic Glaciers. On May 12, 2014, NASA, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, organized a press conference under the title, "The Loss of West Antarctic Glaciers Appears Unstoppable." A new study by researchers at NASA and the University of California, Irvine, finds a rapidly melting section of the West Antarctic ice sheet appears to be in an irreversible state of decline, with nothing to stop the glaciers in this area from melting into the sea. The Pine Island, Thwaites, Haines, Pope, Smith, and Kohler glaciers discharge ever more rapidly into the Amundsen Sea. And even though the Amundsen Sea embayment is a very small area of the continent of Antarctica, these glaciers contain enough ice to raise global sea level by 4 feet. And they are melting faster than most scientists had expected. These findings, we're told, will require an upward revision to current predictions of sea level rise. A world trying to understand the rapid melting of the Greenland ice sheet now needs to turn its attention to a continent at the bottom of the globe that seemed too far away and too massively frozen to be of concern. The media reacted with shock and surprise. Was this the fearfully anticipated moment of no return? The tipping point from which no recovery is possible? What is the science at the bottom of these findings? And what is the time frame? How fast will the melting occur? How will the coastlines of the world be altered? All this was addressed in the press conference on May 12, 2014. And will be the topic of the next program on TUC Radio. However, my first question is if and how this event could have been avoided. Why is the melting of parts of the Antarctic ice sheet a surprise to the public of the world? While it was no surprise at all to scientists who have been studying the impact of climate change on Antarctica for almost 50 years. They made clear for some time that the melting from the West Antarctic ice sheet already contributes significantly to sea level rise. Releasing almost as much ice into the ocean annually as the entire Greenland ice sheet. The late Ohio State University glaciologist John Mercer said in 1968 that the West Antarctic ice sheet is the single largest threat of rapid sea level rise. In 1978, he wrote in the magazine Nature, "If the global consumption of fossil fuels continues to grow at its present rate, the resultant greenhouse warming effect could start rapid deglaciation of West Antarctica, leading to a 5-meter rise in sea level." Mercer knew already from the first research flights in the 1960s that made radar measurements over West Antarctica that the West Antarctic ice sheet is a marine-based ice sheet. That means that the soils and rock the ice sheet lies on are well below sea level, and the edges of the ice sheet flow into the Amundsen Sea as floating ice shelves. The close contact between glacier and water and the accelerating intrusion of water under the ice sheet makes them extremely vulnerable to rising ocean temperatures. The glaciologist Eric Rigneau at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, Pasadena, California, and the University of California, Irvine, followed decades of research and theory to explain how and why the West Antarctic ice sheet is inherently vulnerable. The latest arrival of satellite observation, in addition to airplane overflights, have allowed them to see and quantify what exactly is happening at the base of the glaciers and their so-called grounding lines, where the ice sheet is attached to bed of rock or soil and meets up with the sea. You will hear details of the important new discoveries in the realm of the invisible from Eric Regnault, the lead scientist of the NASA Jet Propulsion Lab collaboration, on the next program. For this program of TUC Radio, I will be handing you over to Professor Chris Rapley, who is famous for his inspired and intelligent descriptions of Antarctica. He was the director of the British Antarctic Survey when I interviewed him in 2005. The BAS operates 5 research stations, as well as ships and aircraft, in Antarctica. Chris Rapley had been the keynote speaker at the 2005 symposium on Avoiding Dangerous Climate Change. The aim of the symposium had been to, quote, advance scientific understanding of and encourage an international scientific debate on the long-term implications of climate change. The relevance of stabilization goals and options to reach such goals. It had been the first conference where highly respected scientists stepped out of their imposed objectivity and issued a warning of impending danger. At the Avoiding Dangerous Climate Change conference, Rapley used the phrase awakening giant to describe what was going on in West Antarctica. The media picked it up and it made a splash. The climate change deniers subsequently accused him of being alarmist. The issue was forgotten and no action was taken. Here's part of my 2005 interview with Chris Rapley as introduction in the unknown world of Antarctica. Why is the Antarctic so important for global climate?
It is the 5th largest continent. It's the highest, coldest, windiest, and ironically driest continent because, of course, all the water that's down there is frozen. And it contains a huge amount of ice. It contains over 90% of the world's fresh water frozen up there. Of course, it's a much smaller percentage of the total water because the oceans are salty. But what's really important is that if you melted all of that ice, it would raise global mean sea level by 52 meters, which would have a huge impact globally. But from the point of view of today, this big dome of ice, it's up to 4 kilometers thick, has an absolutely dominant effect on the atmospheric circulation of the southern hemisphere, and the cold water that's generated around the Antarctic chills about 40% of the world's ocean. So it's like a refrigerator for the world's ocean, and it has a big impact on the ocean currents that circulate all over the world. And we know that the ocean currents are really important from the climatic point of view. If we just consider Europe for a start, Europe is about 5 to 10 degrees warmer than it should be at its latitude because so much heat is drawn northwards by the Gulf Stream. And we believe that all of these currents are interconnected, so changes down in the Antarctic can affect even the way currents far in the north, like the Gulf Stream, work. So it's a key cog in the machinery of the climate system.
Let's go to more recent developments. I remember when the Larsen A broke off, quite a few people got worried and others said, well, that's, you know, normal. It keeps happening. But then in 1998, the Wilkins broke off, and in 2002, Larsen B. What do you make of these ice shelf disintegrations?
Yeah, this is a really interesting story, and it's worth just saying a couple of things first. I mean, the first thing to understand is that snowfall accumulates ice on the continent. And it's like, you can think of it like porridge, I suppose. It slowly flows under its own weight towards the coast. It's guided into streams of flow by the mountains that it's flowing over, sometimes buried, you know, very deep under the ice. And it ultimately reaches the coast, and around the Antarctic, about 80% of the coastline is fringed by thick floating ice. This isn't frozen ocean. This is not, you know, chilled air that has just frozen the surface of the ocean. That's called sea ice, and there's a huge area of that around the Antarctic which grows and shrinks each year. But this is stuff that is extruded. It's flowed off the continent. It's floating. It's maybe anywhere between a kilometer and 100 meters thick. And it flows outwards at anything up to about a kilometer or so per year. And ultimately, big bits break off the end of it as icebergs, and they float away off into the ocean. So it's perfectly normal for this cycle of snowfall accumulating on the continent, flow, and then loss of icebergs off these ice shelves. What's different in the Antarctic Peninsula is that there's been a very, very strong regional warming there. We know that from our measurements over 40 years that temperatures have gone up there at about five times the rate that temperatures have gone up elsewhere on the planet on average. So 2.5 degrees there as opposed to about half a degree the global average. It's interesting that the two other areas that are real rapidly warming spots, hot spots, are in Siberia and Alaska.
Excuse me, I actually don't understand it. It's so well cooled. Why should it be warming?
It's a feedback system. In any complicated connected system, there are links. You do one thing and it has consequences. And in the polar regions, there are some strong positive feedbacks. So let's just take some ice on some dark rock. The ice is white. Ice and snow is white. So when it's sunny, the sunlight gets reflected away. So most of the heat that's coming in from the sun just hits the surface. Because it's white, it bounces it off, and away it goes. If you blowtorch an area of that snow to reveal black rock, then the rock absorbs the heat and will melt more ice, which will absorb more heat, and it'll melt more ice and so on. So you get this positive feedback. Let's just deal with the peninsula, because there are a couple of really important points about that. We've just had this paper, Alison Cook's paper, published. It got a lot of interest about the 224 glaciers that she has studied using 40 years worth of airborne and satellite data. And whereas 40 years ago pretty much all of them were just slowly extending, because almost certainly because of the warming, well, I don't think there's any doubt about it, because of the temperature warming, 87% of them are now in retreat. So you probably wouldn't expect too much else, but it is a dramatic demonstration, confirmation if you like, that this warming is regional and that it's important, it's significant. And I mean, it has knock-on effects, you know, on how far penguins colonize to breed and so on. So it's having ecosystem impacts. But, you know, the things fluctuate all the time, so perhaps that's not so important. What is interesting is that associated with this, there have been the collapse of the ice shelves that you were talking about, the Larsen A, the Larsen B, the Wordy, and so on. Quite a lot of ice shelves have gone. And what we see happening is that where the summer melting can extend to is critical. As that line has moved south, where you get significant summer ponding, meltwater ponding on the top of these ice shelves, that seems to be crucial in damaging the fabric and the strength of the ice shelves, which leaves them vulnerable then to dramatic collapse. And what some of the people here at Bass found a few years ago is that in the ocean sediments underneath those ice shelves, there's evidence that 3,000 to 5,000 years ago, the northern ones had disintegrated and been absent for some time. So what we learn from that is that the climate system is perfectly capable of fluctuating in that region without any human beings being around driving cars or emitting carbon dioxide, and those ice shelves collapsed. But they reformed again. And what we find now is that the that progression further south has reached the point where the ice shelves that have collapsed more recently, the Larsen B, the sediments from those, and this is work by some US researchers, show that those ice shelves have been intact at least over that period back to the last peak of the last ice age, 20,000 years ago. This warming has now reached ice shelves that previous fluctuations hadn't reached. And that begins to ring alarm bells because it implies that that really is something to do with humans rather than just another fluctuation. The fact that it's happened so quickly is also evidence that it's unusual. But that actually isn't the thing that really worries me. There was a guy called Mercer in 78 who wrote a seminal paper on the potential for the West Arctic ice sheet to collapse. I'll come back to that in a minute. But in his paper, he said, if we begin to see a progressive collapse of ice shelves in the peninsula, what will be really interesting is to see whether the glaciers that are feeding them accelerate. Because if they do, then the loss of those ice shelves is important for the future of global mean sea level, because more ice will be pouring into the ocean, and that means it won't be an equilibrium situation where you've got a balance between water accumulating on the continent of the Antarctic and then sliding into the sea and maintaining sea level. But you'll have more sliding off, and so that will cause sea level to rise. And that's exactly what we've seen over the last decades using satellite imagery and satellite lasers, a mixture of European and US satellite data. So that's the peninsula story. Mercer was talking about the West Antarctic ice sheet, which is has got a 5-meter sea level equivalent. And the reason he was concerned about that was that it sits on rock that is well below sea level, anything up to a couple of kilometers below sea level. And so he pointed out that if that starts to melt and slide, there's huge water pressure at its base. And so the ocean might penetrate underneath, lubricating its slippage. And that might cause a rapid collapse. He wasn't very clear what he meant by rapid, but, you know, hundreds of years, maybe thousands of years. He was a bit vague. The East Antarctic ice sheet, by the way, most of it sits on rock above sea level, and so it's not susceptible to that sliding mechanism. Anyway, what the satellite data show us is that an area of the West Antarctic ice sheet, this Pine Island, Thwaites and Smith Glacier area in the Amundsen Sea embayment, is discharging large quantities of ice, about 250 cubic kilometers a year, which is equivalent to about 0.24 millimeters of global mean sea level rise per year, which is sort of significant. It's about 15% of the sea level rise that we measure overall. And it's the idea that the loss of the fringing ice shelf could lead to this sort of acceleration of that, that means that I think we have to worry a lot more about what's going on there. You know, the new evidence of significant loss from this area of the West Antarctic ice sheet, coupled with the knowledge now that when you lose ice shelves, it does cause the ice streams and glaciers to accelerate, means that I think we've got to reevaluate the whole thing. And so we need to go and make measurements of it, close at hand and from space, to reassure ourselves one way or another whether it is a danger.
I think quite a few people are familiar with the part of the ocean circulation that's called the Gulf Stream. But is it true that these enormous ocean streams are all sort of linked to each other?
There's a very famous U.S. scientist called Wally Broker, and he came up with the phrase, the ocean conveyor belt or conveyor system, 10, 15 years ago, maybe a bit longer. And you can draw a very neat little diagram on a global map that shows how cold water that's generated down in the Antarctic sinks to the bottom of the ocean, and it draws water down from the tropics, which then links into all three of the major ocean basins, Pacific, Atlantic, and Indian. And you can see how all of these currents link together. Now, actually, the truth of the matter is just a little bit more subtle than that, because the oceans are full of circular eddies, just like the atmosphere has weather systems in it. And so more of the energy in the motion of the water in the ocean is in sort of circular spinning motions than in just being translated along like a conveyor belt. So what we're really talking about is the net effect of all of this turbulent motion. There is no doubt that the net effect is to carry a heat and salt and water around the world in a continuous stream. And the fact that the Antarctic is so important in generating these very cold streams of water, that it has an effect worldwide.
Now, how can global warming around the Antarctic affect this very delicately balanced system of circulation?
I'm not sure I'd completely accept that it's very delicately balanced. It might be. I think we don't know. And although there are ever-improving computer models of the ocean and the atmosphere, and indeed the coupled ocean and atmosphere, the extent to which, for example, the Gulf Stream might cut itself off and paradoxically, through global warming, plunge Europe into a slightly colder phase, the two things would more or less compensate in some of the models. The extent to which the ocean is vulnerable to that isn't really well sorted out yet. But nevertheless, it's absolutely clear that in the past, the Earth has had very different climate patterns. I mean, we know that there's been a whole series over the last 30 million years of ice age cycles, warm periods and cold periods. During the cold periods, the ocean circulation and atmospheric circulation was very different to the pattern that we have today. And what we're worried about is that there's evidence in previous cold periods that the whole pattern of ocean and atmospheric circulation could suddenly shift into a different pattern. It's called a regime shift. And there's evidence that this could happen under those circumstances very quickly in periods of less than 10 years, higher resolution than we can actually resolve in the ice cores and sediments that we get this data from. Now, what we don't know is whether the climate system in a warm period, which is what we're in now, is as vulnerable. The so-called Holocene, this last 10,000 years, has been unusually stable. And indeed, people argue that it's because it's been stable that it's allowed human society and agriculture and technology and all of those things to develop. It's been a sort of benign period. But whether or not we're pushing the limit so that we might lose that stability, we don't know.
So as a layperson, one is really impressed by these amazing libraries of ice cores. They do show this very sort of even up and down of heating and cooling over time. But don't the ice cores also show, by the analysis of the embedded air, that we have added two of the ingredients in larger numbers than ever before?
Oh yes, sorry. This, and of course, the climate skeptics are very much on to this at present. They call it the hockey stick diagram, and they claim that various ways in which the past temperature of the planet have been estimated from what they call proxy measures, from thickness of tree rings and a variety of other ways. And the way that those data have been connected to the recent, 150 years of actual temperature record data is flawed. But that's the temperature stuff. I don't believe that anyway. I think there have been some very careful analyses that show that the global mean temperature really has gone up by about 0.6 of a degree over the last 100 years, and mainly over the last 40 years. The thing that the climate skeptics kind of duck and weave about and don't address is the fact that we have bubbles of gas in these ice cores, which we know to be anything up to 900,000 years old. That's the oldest ice that's been extracted so far. And we've had ice cores going back 450,000 years for some time now, and have very carefully analyzed the carbon dioxide and methane content of the gas in those bubbles. And there's just no question that the carbon dioxide content of the atmosphere has increased by 37% since the Industrial Revolution. If it continues to rise at this rate, and the projections are not very reassuring, then we will at least double and possibly go even further than that, the level of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. This will be not only the largest rise, but also the fastest rise, certainly over the last million years, and arguably over the last 30 million years or even 100 million years. And that sort of shock to the system is bound to have consequences. Now, you can argue like mad about, you know, how severe they'll be and what, you know, what will it do to me and my backyard. But you can't do that sort of thing to this incredibly complicated and interconnected system and not have it react, particularly when you've more than doubled the amount of methane in the atmosphere over the same period. So you asked me earlier on, what, you know, why is the Antarctic important in climate research? It's important, firstly, because it is, as I say, a key cog in the machinery. But it's also an absolute treasure trove of information about how the planet has behaved in the past, how the climate system's behaved in the past. And when you combine that information with information from other ice cores in Greenland and ocean sediments and lake sediments, all of which are like a sort of detective story where you're, it's like a forensic investigation. When you put all that information together, then you can build up a picture that shows that humans are really doing things to the planet that we ought to worry about.
That was Professor Chris Rapley. I interviewed him as follow-up to the symposium on avoiding dangerous climate change, where he had been a keynote speaker. That symposium, held at the Hadley Center in Britain in February 2005, was intended to finally break through denial of climate change and encourage action to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. No action was taken, and sadly, 9 years after Rapley gave that interview, in May 2014, NASA organized a press conference under the title, "The Loss of West Antarctic Glaciers Appears Unstoppable." Come back when TUC Radio returns to hear from glaciologist Eric Rigneault of the University of California, Irvine, and NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory on the glaciers in the Amundsen Sea sector of West Antarctica. According to Rigneault and his team, these glaciers have passed the point of no return. This new study has been accepted for publication in Geophysical Research Letters, a journal of the American Geophysical Union. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Open the newest programs page and scroll down. This program was produced off the grid with solar power. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations and free as podcast online. This is an unfunded program that depends entirely on donations by listeners. You can contact TUC Radio online at tucradio.org. The email is tuc@tucradio.org. TUC Radio takes its name from an aeronautical term. Time of useful consciousness is the time between the beginning of oxygen deficiency and the loss of consciousness, the brief moment in which a pilot may save the plane. My name is Maria Glodden. Thank you for listening.